to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201 CD 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Yesterday, October 26th, approximately a quarter of a million Americans marched against the government's Iraq war plans. In Washington, D.C., a crowd of around 150,000 surrounded the White House perimeter. In San Francisco, a march estimated at 100,000 stretched over a mile through downtown as packed subway trains continued to pour into the city with additional protesters. Cities and towns from coast to coast also held anti-war protests, and thousands turned out in cities abroad. National Public Radio's Weekend Edition inaccurately reported the Washington, D.C. march attendance as 10,000 people. Other commercial networks made no mention of the protests in weekend newscasts. Marchers and speakers at this weekend's events acknowledged the stand for peace taken by the late Senator Paul Wellstone, who died Friday in a plane crash. The Minnesota Democrat had been in a close race for re-election against an opponent described as hand-picked by the Bush administration. Wellstone had pulled ahead of his challenger in the polls after voting against war powers for Bush. Closer to home, Ithacans are mourning the passing of a lifelong peacemaker, John Peter Grady Sr., who passed away on October 23rd of a heart attack. He was 77. He'd lived in Ithaca since 1973 and was a former professor at Ithaca College. John was born in the South Bronx, a son of Irish immigrants. He attended school and college in New York City and served in the U.S. Navy during World War II. He returned to Manhattan College after the war, where he founded the still-existing Gaelic Society. While at Fordham University in pursuit of a doctorate in sociology, he received a Fulbright scholarship to the London School of Economics. In 1956, John married Teresa Shaughnessy of Chicago, Illinois. Together, they had five children, Mary Ann, Claire, John, Ellen, and Teresa, who live in Ithaca. John served on the New York City Planning Board, was business manager for Jubilee Magazine, and worked with Father Alvaro de Boer and Ivan Illich in a cross-cultural program in Puerto Rico from 1959 to 1960. And then he ran for Congress as a Eugene McCarthy peace candidate in 1968. He also founded and directed the Drew Foundation in Harlem, a combination Montessori school and Head Start program that integrated European American and African American children. He and the attorney Charles Rangel set up the foundation to explicitly disprove the prevailing view that African American intelligence was inferior. In 1964, he attended a peace summit of eight Christian leaders, including Thomas Merton, the Berrigan brothers, and A.J. Musty, who gathered to discuss what to do about America's growing involvement in Vietnam. In 1967, Father Philip Berrigan decided to take up nonviolent civil disobedience to protest the Vietnam War by destroying draft records. John Peter subsequently joined him and became the main organizer of draft board raids, where hundreds of thousands of records were destroyed at dozens of Selective Service offices. Selective Service was closed down in 1973, the same year John Peter was on trial with 27 others in Camden, New Jersey for a 1971 draft board raid. The 3.5-month Camden 28 trial ended in acquittal. Supreme Court Justice William Brennan commented that the Camden trial was one of the greatest trials of the 20th century. John Peter Grady's courageous works were recounted in a recently published book, Peace Warriors. Thank you. Scott Ritter is another former soldier who has become a peace warrior. A former Marine Corps major, Ritter served for 7 years as the United Nations Chief Weapons Inspector in Iraq. He resigned from his position in 1998, protesting that the U.S. government had dangerously subverted the weapons inspection process. Today, Ritter is a vocal critic of the Bush administration's plans to attack Iraq, arguing that Saddam Hussein is a phantom menace. Ritter argues that the U.S. government is exploiting public fear and anxiety to promote an agenda with catastrophic implications. He spoke earlier this month in Seattle on the coming war in Iraq. How did we get here?
I'm here as a private American citizen in solidarity with you, my fellow citizens, about an issue of grave concern. That issue is, frankly speaking, a life and death decision for thousands, many of whom might be in this room, most of whom aren't. Thousands of Americans, thousands of Iraqis, thousands of citizens of the world. I'm talking about war, the coming war with Iraq. Now, I've been speaking about the coming war with Iraq for years now, and even as recently as June, when I spoke before a group of congressmen, and they were Republicans, by the way, the Democrats, I think, had a clue what was happening, but the Republicans were trying to delude themselves, and I think I need to be, truth in advertising here. I am a Republican. Card-carrying Republican, conservative, moderate in my political views, and I voted for George W. Bush for president. So I'm not up here to make a political statement to bash the president, to bash the Republicans. I am a Republican. I'm up here as an American citizen concerned about the direction my country's going in. Now, for the past 4 years, I've been confronting the American people with the real probability of war between the United States and Iraq. And I've been treated sort of like the boy who cries wolf, or, Chicken Little, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. And everybody said, no, Scott, there's not going to be a war. It's really not going to happen. As recent as June, Republicans in Congress, Scott, the president will not lead us down the path to war. He's just bluffing. He's trying to get the Iraqis to cave in. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to war. That's the fact, unless something's done to stop it. How can we stop this war? And that's what we're talking about. Now, I hope none of you are in here tonight to feel good about yourselves, to say, hey, I went to that presentation. Aren't I a good citizen? I feel really good about myself. I've traveled around the country. I've traveled around the world, and I've seen a lot of desire. I've seen a lot of desire for peace. A lot of people desire peace. A lot of people want peace. Very few will peace. Do you have the will for peace? This is the question you have to ask yourself. Do you have the will? Because it's going to take will. It's probably the FBI wanting to know directions. Tonight's event. But what I want to talk to you tonight is about this coming war. But in order to address this, I really want to talk to you about some pieces of paper. I want you to reflect on pieces of paper. The first piece of paper I want you to reflect on is a document that was signed a couple hundred years ago, called the Constitution of the United States of America. It's an important document, important in a number of ways. One, it defines who we are as a people. And it says we are a people respectful of laws, a nation of laws. We're a people who respect human rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It speaks of, and this is what you need to get into your heads, it speaks of we, the people of the United States of America. It speaks of government of the people, by the people, for the people. If you sit here and say that the American government is leading us down the path to hell, no, you are. You're to blame. You're the government. What are you doing to stop this war? Is the question you have to ask yourself over and over again. And it's not a rhetorical question, it's a real question, because the Constitution puts the responsibility for the running of this country firmly in your hands, in our hands. We, the people of the United States of America. That's the first piece of paper I want you to consider. The second piece of paper I'd like you to consider is the Gettysburg Address. And the reason why I bring this up is that the Gettysburg Address is a document that more eloquently than most I can think of discusses why democracies like ours go to war. Let's talk about war for a second. I don't think too many people talk about the reality of war. We're on the verge of war with Iraq. This is not a Nintendo game. When you die, you don't hit reset and come back to life. War is real. Real. I'm a 12-year veteran in the Marine Corps. When I took my Marines onto the firing line to shoot at paper targets from 200, 300, 500 meters or yards, it wasn't because the United States of America like to punch holes in white pieces of paper. I'm training my Marines to send 5.56 millimeters of copper-jacketed metal downrange to penetrate a human body, to rip that body apart, to kill somebody. That's why we train to shoot, to kill. When I sat up on a hill as a Marine with a radio in my hand, calling down artillery and airstrikes on piles of tires in the deserts of California, it wasn't because the United States government had a grudge against Goodyear. It's because they were training me to rain death and destruction down on human beings. Ladies and gentlemen, war is about death. War is about destruction. There is nothing good about war. We must avoid war at all costs. But there comes a time, when nations such as ours must defend ourselves, when nations such as ours have to stand up and fight for what we believe in. The fields of Europe, the fields of the United States, are covered with cemeteries with white crosses and stars of David, marking those who have gone before us, those who have laid down their lives in sacrifice for this great country. And sometimes you do have to pay that price. And Abraham Lincoln reflected on this when he was standing at the battlefield of Gettysburg, looking out on the fields where thousands of Americans had perished. And he wondered why they had to die. And his answer was as such: so that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the face of the earth. Ladies and gentlemen, the only reason we should ever go to war is to preserve our nation, to preserve our way of life. That is what is worthy of the sacrifice of American lives, nothing more, nothing less. So I want you to consider the third document, third piece of paper, the United Nations Charter. We're signatories to the United Nations Charter. The United Nations Charter was created in the aftermath of a horrible global conflict, World War II. And the global community, the community of nations, realized that we can't keep going down this path. This is a path towards annihilation, death. We have to find a way to peacefully coexist. So they formed a community of nations. And they signed a charter. And the charter said, we are committed to peaceful resolution of conflict. Now, the charter also recognized that sometimes you have to defend yourself. It wasn't a utopian concept. They recognized the reality of the world. So the charter set forth conditions under which nations could go to war. First condition, self-defense. If you're attacked, you have the right to defend yourself. The charter recognizes this in Article 51. And we do have a modern-day example to fall back on and consider. September 11th, 2001, our nation was attacked. 19 hijackers took over 4 airplanes, flew them into buildings, and in a span of less than 100 minutes, nearly 3,000 innocent Americans perished. And we found that we had been attacked. And the Security Council of the United Nations likewise recognized this and recognized the United States had the right under Article 51 to defend itself. And we were able to build a coalition of nations under the rule of law to go out and bring to justice those who perpetrated the horrific events on us. Now, you may have problems with the, as I do, with the way we are waging the war on terror. But what I'm telling you is that we are right to defend ourselves. It is something that is permitted under the rule of law. It doesn't make war any good, any less evil, any better. It just means that under the rule of law, we can do this. Second example. The United Nations Charter recognizes that there are times when the international community can collectively find out that one nation or non-nation represents a clear and present risk to international peace and security. And under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter, to pass a resolution authorizing certain actions up to and including military force to hold that nation or group accountable. Example, when Iraq invaded Kuwait in August of 1990, the Security Council passed Resolution 678 that said, "This will not stand. Iraq's actions represent a clear and present risk to international peace and security," and they authorized a coalition of nations to be formed and go in and liberate Kuwait. Not a good war, but a war that was legitimized by the rule of law. I'm not trying to condone war. I'm telling you that under the rules as set forth by international law, there are conditions under which nations may go to war. Now, understand that we have signed the United Nations Charter. In accordance with our Constitution, any international agreement we enter into, any treaty we enter into, carries the force of law here at home. So keep this in mind. If the United States of America enters into a war with anyone that does not meet one of those two criteria, it is a violation of the Constitution of the United States of America. It represents a frontal assault on American democracy. So now let's consider the war on Iraq. Why are we going to war on Iraq?
Oil.
Besides oil. No, we're going to war on Iraq because Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Iraq, well, we're not going to war on ourselves. We're going to war against Iraq because they have weapons of mass destruction. We're going to war on Iraq because Iraq is a state sponsor of terror. We're going on Iraq, war on Iraq, because Iraq is in cahoots with those who perpetrated the attack on us on September 11th, 2001. We're going to war against Iraq because we're concerned Iraq's going to take its weapons of mass destruction, give it to those who perpetrated the attack, and they'll attack us again. But this time, we're told by the President of the United States, this time it'll be worse. More Americans will die. And you know what? A lot of people hear this around the country, and they're scared. They say, my God, we can't let this happen. We have to confront this. We have to go forth and defend ourselves. And that's why you have so many Americans who claim to support a war against Iraq today. The problem is, none of what I just said is true. Weapons of mass destruction? Yeah, Iraq had them. And the international community found that Iraq's possession of weapons of mass destruction represented a clear and present risk to international peace and security, and they authorized a group of weapons inspectors to go into Iraq and disarm them, get rid of these weapons, and off the inspectors marched. Well, let's talk about this for a second. You see, the Security Council passed a resolution 687 saying Iraq can't have chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, and long-range ballistic missiles. And they linked Iraq's disarmament to the lifting of economic sanctions that had been imposed on Iraq when they invaded Kuwait in August 1990. Now, the sanctions were supposed to be lifted when Kuwait was liberated, but they weren't. They were extended, this time linked to Iraq's ability to comply with an obligation to disarm. Now, on the surface, it appears what this resolution is talking about is the disarmament of Iraq.
But let's dig a little deeper, ladies and gentlemen. Let's dig a little deeper. What are they really talking about? Why did we go to war against Iraq in 1991? I know, oil. Yeah, because the Security Council said it was okay. Why did the American people go along with it? If you remember, right after Iraq invaded Kuwait, Secretary of State James Baker came out and was asked that question. Why are we going to fight Iraq? And he said, because of oil. And immediately he was told to shut up by the White House because the president looked out of the Oval Office into Lafayette Square and he saw a lot of American citizens running around with signs saying, no American blood for oil. Clearly, Americans were not prepared to give the blood of their servicemen and women in defense of oil. They had to come up with another reason. Well, it certainly wasn't going to be to defend Kuwaiti democracy. No, the reason was a crusade of good versus evil. You see, we had a problem here. This guy named Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. Now, if we wanted to talk about Saddam Hussein in 1990, remember that before he invaded Kuwait, he just happened to be a pretty good friend of the United States. Now, it would be difficult for the president to talk to the American people and tell them the truth. The truth that for the past decade, we helped arm Iraq, we supported Iraq, we condoned Iraq's use of chemical weapons against Iranians and Kurds. It would be hard for the president to explain why a few months before August, in the spring of 1990, a group of senators traveled to Baghdad, met with Saddam Hussein, and embraced him as a true friend of the American people. How do you go to war against a true friend of the American people? You don't. You demonize him. You see, you don't want to talk about the reality of American-Iraqi relations. You need an enemy. And we turn Saddam Hussein into the personification of evil. We were told that Saddam Hussein is the Middle East equivalent of Adolf Hitler. That Saddam Hussein is all that is evil. Now, when you take this, what you're doing is creating a situation that's black and white. We all know that life isn't that easy. Life is actually a whole bunch of shades of gray. That's called reality. When you define a problem in terms of black and white, it's not a realistic definition of the problem. The other problem is, by defining it in black and white, you come up with a solution. The solution also has to be determined in black and white, which means you have an unrealistic definition of the problem, and now you have an unrealistic solution. Well, the solution to this problem of Saddam Hussein is evil was American troops going off to wage a crusade against evil. And it was a hard sell to the American public, but the president was successful in getting a resolution passed through Congress supporting a war. And 700,000 American troops went off to fight in this conflict. Now, the American people were told that this was a crusade. America versus evil. We're going to hold Saddam Hussein accountable. We're going to take the devil down. Except the international community, in passing its resolution, only said we're going to liberate Kuwait. That's what the war was about. So the war ends, we liberate Kuwait, the American troops come home, and there's great parades in the streets of Washington, D.C. and New York City. And in the background, there's a couple hands going up, going, excuse me, Mr. President, excuse me. You told us we were going to war against evil, and you defined evil as Saddam Hussein, and the troops are home declaring victory, and yet when I look in Baghdad, there he's still sitting. Did we win the war? The president suddenly had a political problem. The problem was defined as Saddam Hussein. Now, how do you deal with Saddam Hussein? You got to get rid of him. But the troops are home. So now, how do you come up with a solution to get rid of Saddam Hussein? Well, first thing you do is you bring all your smart guys together in the White House and you say, Saddam, what's going to happen? And they all scratch their head and they say, he's been defeated militarily. His economy's in tatters. If we can just put a little bit more pressure on him, contain him, and put a little bit more pressure on him, he won't last 6 months. Now, I'm not making this up. Secretary of State James Baker, Richard Haass, and the National Security Council, 6 months is what they gave Saddam Hussein at the end of the Gulf War. 6 months. All we have to do is contain him for 6 months, and he will go away. Now, how do you contain him? Economic sanctions. But a little piece of inconvenience, Kuwait is liberated.
We no longer have an excuse for economic sanctions. We need a new excuse. Enter weapons of mass destruction. Pass a resolution citing Iraq's weapons of mass destruction as a clear and present risk to international peace and security, and link the lifting of economic sanctions to Iraq's compliance with its obligation to be disarmed. Furthermore, you make the resolution so stringent and harsh that for Saddam Hussein to accept the terms of his disarmament, he will be discredited in the eyes of the Iraqi people, and they will remove him from power. Are you getting what the resolution was about? The disarmament resolution was never about disarming Iraq, and always about getting rid of Saddam Hussein. And so they passed the resolution. Now, silly inspectors go in thinking they're really going to try and disarm Iraq, but the purpose actually was to contain Iraq until Saddam Hussein fell. And so the Bush administration sat back and watched the months tick by. 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, 6. Saddam's still there. Their grand theory failed. Now what do? You got to disarm them, because that's what the resolution says. So the inspectors go in to complete a job they were never intended to do, disarm Iraq. Now Saddam Hussein, the reason why he survived is Saddam Hussein knows Iraq a hell of a lot better than we do. Okay, that's a reality. He knew that if he gave in to these requirements to disarm, he would be discredited and he would be overthrown. So Saddam Hussein opposed the measures to be disarmed. He lied. He cheated. He concealed. And the inspectors had to overcome this. That's where I came in. If you look at my resume, you know, I talk about chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, rockets. You won't see physicist, chemist, biologist, or rocket scientist in my resume. I'm none of those. Those guys are much smarter than I am. I'm an intelligence officer. My job is to gather information. The way the inspections were supposed to work is that Iraq was to turn over a declaration listing the totality of its holdings of weapons of mass destruction, the information that would fuel the inspection process. But when they lied, they turned over an incomplete declaration. They failed to declare a nuclear weapons program, a biological weapons program, most of their missiles, a lot of their chemical weapons. They just didn't declare it. So now, initially, the United States wasn't worried about that. A false declaration, who cares? 6 months, Saddam's gone, we'll go in, it'll all be cleaned up. But now Saddam's still there, we got to deal with it. If the Iraqis aren't going to give us information, we got to go get it ourselves. We need to enter the game of intelligence. Get this information. In I come, form an intelligence unit, off I march, get the data we need. To make a long story short, the Iraqis didn't fully cooperate, but after 5 years, in 1996, we were able to ascertain that Iraq was fundamentally disarmed. 95% of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs were accounted for. This includes 100% of the factories used by Iraq to produce weapons of mass destruction, all of the associated production equipment related to those factories, and the vast majority of the product produced by these factories. 95%, ladies and gentlemen, that's a hell of a great accomplishment. And nobody thought we could do it. Especially the United States. You see, it was never about disarming Iraq. You have to understand that. It was about containing Saddam Hussein. And you contain Saddam Hussein with economic sanctions. And the economic sanctions are justified as long as Iraq is seen as not complying with the weapons inspectors. But what happens when the weapons inspectors start succeeding? You threaten the big plan. You see, if we actually ever disarmed Iraq, the law says sanctions have to be lifted. And if you lift the sanctions, you break containment. And if you break containment, Iraq comes back into the family, the fold of the international community with Saddam Hussein still at the helm, which is not what the master plan calls for. You don't want the inspectors to succeed. But that's okay, you see, because you passed a stringent resolution that called for 100%. Not 95%. So even if we come up and say, hey, we've done this great job, 95%, not only 95% accounted for, but get this. In addition to disarming Iraq, we monitored Iraq. We had inspectors in Iraq covering the totality of Iraq's industrial infrastructure with cameras, sensors, no-notice inspections for 4 years, 1994 to 1998. The Iraqis never obstructed this work, and we never found any evidence of retained prohibited capability or reconstitution of prohibited capability. So that sort of mitigates this remaining 5%. You know, where is it? We didn't find it. We can't account for it. We don't know what the final disposition is. But we don't have any evidence that says Iraq actually has it. We just don't know where it is. I don't know about you, but I can't find 100% of anything in my closet. Does that mean I'm a liar or a criminal? No, it just means I'm a human being. And something as complicated as Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs, especially after bombing and trying to conceal and a whole bunch of other issues, it's virtually impossible to come up with 100%. So 95% is a darn good figure, but not good enough under the law. Not good enough under the law. We needed 100%. Not because we need to disarm Iraq, but we need to justify the continuation of sanctions. Now, when you say you got to get rid of Saddam Hussein, though, and that, of course, is the policy of the United States, getting rid of Saddam Hussein. Now, initially, it's a passive policy, as put forward by the first Bush administration. Again, we just surround Saddam with sanctions, we put pressure on him, and he disappears. Well, Saddam didn't disappear. Bush did. Clinton comes in. And Clinton said an amazing thing. He said, I'm a Southern Baptist, and I believe in deathbed conversions. I think we can get Saddam to change his spots. I think if we just talk to this guy, we can get him to see the reason, and we can resolve this whole thing. An interesting concept, except for one thing. Congress shot him down. Why? Because Saddam Hussein had been demonized in the psyche of the American public to the extent that no one was willing to accept a deal with the devils. You see, when you characterize somebody as the devil, you make it impossible to deal with him. Impossible. No congressman was willing to stand up and say, I support engagement with Saddam Hussein to his constituents. Because his constituents would say, how can you deal with the devil? He now has a political vulnerability that can be exploited by an opponent who says, this man's soft on Saddam. That's the end of it. You're gone. So no congressman would support it. Bill Clinton got slapped down and was forced to inherit this policy of containment. But Clinton said, you know, I'm not just going to sit here and wait for Saddam to go. I'm going to help him go. CIA, come on in, boys. Go get him. And the CIA tried. They launched 4 coups in the period of 4 years. And they all failed. Why? Because Saddam Hussein has one of the most brutally efficient security services the world has ever seen. Saddam Hussein is virtually coup-proof. You're just not going to get close enough to him to apply the 75-cent solution, which is the cost of one bullet in the head. It isn't going to happen. So you contain him. Now, back to the inspectors. Here we are, 95%. We've done a good job, but we have to get it remaining 5%. I told you about my resume that I'm not a physicist or a chemist or a biologist or a rocket scientist, but I did take fifth grade science. And fifth grade science taught me about the nervous system of a frog. Now, what does that have to do with weapons inspections? A lot. You see, I knew in my frog class that if I took a pin and poked a frog, I found out what cause and effect was, the nervous system. Now, this might be prohibited today. I don't know about prevention for cruelty to animals, but this is what happened when I was in fifth grade. Cause and effect. We have to go after the weapons. We don't know where they are. We don't even know if they exist. But we have a piece of information that says that they're being protected by Saddam Hussein's security apparatus. Now, there's no master book sitting in the library called Saddam Hussein's Security Apparatus. You can pull off the shelf, open up, flip the pages and go, up, concealment of weapons of mass destruction, page 46. They're hidden in the following facilities. No, it doesn't work that way. We don't know anything about this guy, how his protection services work. So we have to launch this great frog experiment. We send inspectors into Baghdad, knock on the door of Saddam Hussein's security barracks, and then see how the Iraqis respond. And it's a fun game, you see. We get to fly airplanes over Baghdad taking pictures. I get to put teams inside Baghdad with headphones on, spinning the dials, intercepting conversations of senior Iraqi leaders. I get to recruit guys and put them inside the facility so they can report on what's happening. It's called collecting data. And we see how the Iraqis respond. We go to the first facility, come in, the Iraqis, they're moving around. Giant experiment, collecting data, guys, collect data, collect data. Go to the next facility. We're coming in, collect data, collect data, collect data. Compare the data, find out where you get points of intersection, focus on it, and keep the experiment going until you get a cause and effect relationship that tells you which parts of the Iraqi security apparatus respond to the inspection input.
Nice concept. And it worked, except for one thing. You see, the law that gave me the right to go to every one of those facilities, the Security Council resolution, also said that we had to respect the dignity, sovereignty, and national security of Iraq. And after a while, Iraq went, whoa, what do these facilities have to do with weapons of mass destruction? And we couldn't answer that question. We just said, we have a right to go here. And they said, nope, you're not coming in. Now we had an impasse. We couldn't go into the facility. Giant obstruction. Now, you probably saw this on TV. You've seen the video clips. Scott Ritter standing there with his hands on his hips, putting his hand like this, saying, I have to go in. Some unfortunate Iraqi soldier with a black beret saying, no, 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 you can't come in. And everybody who saw that assumed that behind that door were weapons of mass destruction. No, we didn't know what was behind there. We were just doing it to provoke a response. And we got it. An AK-47 in our face that said, you can't go in. So now we have an impasse. We have to resolve it. In comes a Swedish diplomat named Rolf Ekéus. He flies to Baghdad. He meets with Tarek Aziz. Tarek Aziz says, these sites are sensitive to our security. Rolf Ekéus says, we get to go anywhere we want to. Compromise. The modalities for sensitive site inspections. When inspectors show up at one of these facilities, the Iraqis have a right to declare it sensitive. In doing so, they limit the size of the inspection team to 4 people. See, prior to that, it was Scott Ritter and 40 other to 60 other inspectors pouring in, taking it down brick by brick. That's okay if it's a factory, but when it's Saddam Hussein's bodyguard unit and we're leafing through documents that contain the secret codes and the location of Saddam and how he's protected, they don't like that. So 4 guys go in, we get to do anything we want, and if we determine that the site has nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction, we leave. If, however, we find out there's something related to our mandate, send in the cavalry, we get to do whatever we want to do. And you know what? This worked. From 1996 to 1998, it didn't work perfectly, but we got into every facility we wanted to get into. We investigated. We did more cause and effect relationship. We started to narrow down the targets. And you know what we started to find? That there's a heck of a lot of concealment taking place in Iraq related to the weapons inspectors. You know what they were concealing, though? Not weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein's security secrets. They still care about the protection of their president. And why shouldn't they? The United States has a policy of taking them out. And the last thing they want is some 6'4", 220-pound Marine coming in and grabbing this secret. So they hide it. They hide it. And we started to close in on the reality that there's probably no weapons left in Iraq. Oh, this is a very dangerous thing, though, if you're an American. An American who supports a policy of continuing to contain Saddam until the CIA can figure out a way to get rid of him. Now, remember the CIA failed? And the reason why they failed is because they didn't know anything about Saddam Hussein's security apparatus? Well, guess what, ladies and gentlemen? Scott Ritter just handed them a birthday gift. I gave them the keys to the presidential palaces. I gave them the keys to understanding where Saddam sleeps at night, how his convoys operate, who protects them, how they protect them, when they protect them, where they protect them. Suddenly, the United States had the ability to get rid of Saddam Hussein, courtesy of the United Nations. Now, we didn't do it on purpose. It's not as though we went in there and said, we're going to collect this data and turn it over to the United States and they can get rid of Saddam. We went in there trying to resolve the issue, and we did. We resolved the issue. We investigated the issue. We found out that there's probably nothing left. So the United States now has to act, and act quickly. It has to do 2 things. One, it needs to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And failing that, get rid of the inspectors. Because the inspectors are starting to threaten their policy of regime removal. December 1998. The United States prevails upon the weapons inspectors to send a team to Baghdad. The team is told to go to sites that are deliberately provocative. One of these sites is the Adamiya Ba'ath Party headquarters. Ba'ath Party headquarters, that's a political party, not a weapons factory. The inspectors show up and the Iraqis go, this is a sensitive site. You're welcome to come in accordance with the modalities of sensitive site inspections. And the inspectors, under order from Richard Butler, the Australian, who took over from Rolf Ekéus in the summer of 1997, ripped up the modalities and said they no longer apply. Why did they do that? Because the United States ordered them to do that. Why did the United States order them to do that? Because they knew what the Iraqis would do, which is If the modalities don't apply, you can't come in. And now the inspectors report back. The Iraqis are not cooperating. And the United States orders the inspectors out and then bombs Iraq, using this non-cooperation as justification for military action. Furthermore, all that nice intelligence information that we gathered about Iraq's security was used to target Iraq, to bomb facilities, to go after Saddam Hussein. More than 120 targets were struck, less than a dozen of them dealt with industrial capabilities with potential use in weapons of mass destruction, and even those dozen were subjected to monitoring by inspectors, and we knew damn well there wasn't anything bad happening in those factories, but we blew them up anyways. But most of the targets were Saddam's security sites. Now, we didn't get Saddam. We very rarely do get these guys that we go after. We don't have a good record in Special Forces. We call it a Where's Waldo exercise. You know that cartoon where you're looking for Waldo? We don't do Where's Waldo very well. Just ask Mohammed Farid Aidid. Just ask Osama bin Laden. And maybe you'll get to ask Saddam Hussein. We don't do this very well. We failed in December 1998 to get Saddam, but we did succeed in killing the inspectors. Because the Iraqis aren't stupid. They knew what happened, and they turned around and said the inspectors aren't welcome to come back in. Because you're nothing more than spies in the United States of America. And unfortunately, they were right. They were right. So that's the situation. That's the situation we face today, ladies and gentlemen. No inspectors in Iraq. Now, I resigned in 1998, before December 1998. I resigned in August because I said, I'm not going to be part of this game. I'm not going to be part of this charade. You see, I believe in the rule of law. I believe that Saddam Hussein must be held fully accountable to the law. I view Saddam Hussein as a criminal. And I view myself and the other inspectors as police officers who are carrying out an investigation of a criminal. But what happens when you have a criminal? Let's call him a drug dealer. Four-time convicted drug dealer. Now he's back out of jail. He's on the streets. And we think he's running a crack house on the corner. So the cops come in. Now, if the cops run a clean investigation and they get the goods on the guy, he's held accountable to the rule of law. Off to jail he goes. But what happens if the cops plant evidence? What happens if the cops do an illegal wiretap? What happens if they do an illegal search and seizure? The case is thrown out. Now, does this mean that the drug dealer is not a criminal? No, it doesn't. But it means the cops broke the law. The cops became corrupt. Ladies and gentlemen, the inspectors broke the law. The inspectors became corrupt. We were no longer able to maintain the integrity of the prosecution. This doesn't mean, though, that Saddam Hussein is no longer a threat. When I resigned, I clearly stated that Iraq had not been disarmed fully in accordance with the law. And they hadn't. The law says 100%. We could attest to 95%. I also stated that once you remove inspectors from Iraq, Iraq will be able to take its civilian infrastructure and convert it to produce weapons of mass destruction within a period of 6 months. And inspectors have been away from Iraq now for almost 4 years. So it's very easy for the Bush administration to say the Iraqis could have rebuilt their weapons program in the intervening 4 years. And you know, with no weapons inspectors in Iraq, that's a mythology that can carry some weight. The Bush administration has told you that this is a war that's going to be fought because of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Nope. Can't buy that one anymore, ladies and gentlemen. Why? The Iraqis just said they're willing to let the inspectors back in, to come in and do the job, hold them fully accountable to the law. And the Bush administration wouldn't take yes for an answer. Shut the door on the inspectors. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's dispel the first myth. It's not about weapons of mass destruction. Iraq doesn't have them. They don't pose a threat to anyone. Let's make that clear. Now, we've also been told by the president that Saddam Hussein is an evil man. No debate here. We've been told that Saddam Hussein is a criminal. The president stood before the United Nations and said Saddam Hussein is in violation of 16 resolutions, that Saddam Hussein has committed crimes against humanity. And I say, yes, Mr. President, I agree. And because I am someone who believes in the rule of law,
I believe we should hold Saddam Hussein accountable to the rule of law. I want an indictment of Saddam Hussein in the International Court of Justice. If you want regime removal, indict Saddam. Oh, wait, whoa, I forgot something. I forgot something, though. We don't support the International Court of Justice. We don't support the rule of law. So what's this about? It's not about weapons of mass destruction. It's not about Saddam Hussein. Ladies and gentlemen, what's it about? I'm going to introduce you to another piece of paper. It's called the National Security Strategy Document, put out by the Bush administration 2 weeks ago. You know what this document says? This document says that the United States of America will take advantage of its overwhelming military and economic strength to impose a unilateral American solution on the world, regardless of international law. You know what this document says, ladies and gentlemen? It says that the United States is going to become an imperial power. Well, it may be, but now we're finally admitting it. It's a blatant admission that the United States is giving up on international law. That the United States will preemptively strike out any time we see fit. Not what the international community says, not what law says, but when we unilaterally determine that there's a situation in the globe that we don't like, we will act unilaterally. Now, you want to know why we're going to war with Iraq? Because Iraq is the initial case study of implementation of an American policy of unilateral action, and we must stop it. Now this is not going to be an easy struggle. This is not going to be an easy struggle at all. It's one that's going to be fought using vicious tactics by the other side. And I hate to say it, but there is another side. Ladies and gentlemen, I know everybody out here is a peaceful spirit. You're religious people. You believe in peace. And I support that. But you've got to start thinking like a military person. President Bush is speaking of waging war. I urge you to wage peace. Wage peace in the same manner. What this means is you have to wake up to the harsh reality. Now, as a Marine Corps officer, I took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Representative Jim McDermott took the same oath. The same oath. This means foreign and domestic. We have a domestic threat today against the Constitution of the United States, and it resides in Washington, D.C. And we need to wage peace. We need to wage peace, and it's not going to be easy. No, they're going to bring out all the tactics. First thing we have to understand to wage peace is what we're fighting for. American democracy, plain and simple. That's what we're fighting for. Now, what does American democracy mean? You know, I come from New York. I know, bad place. But in Albany, New York, we had an issue. The Hudson River. General Electric dumped some PCBs in it. It was polluted, and they were talking about dredging the river. And it was a big issue. Do you dredge it? Do you don't dredge it? And there were a lot of people concerned about this. And the citizens got up, rose up, got together, formed civic action groups. And there were pros and there were cons, and they debated. They held their elected representatives accountable. They had town hall meetings, brought them forward, discussed it. And in the end, there was a vote, and one side won. But at the end of the vote, when that one side won, you didn't see anybody reaching over and saying, all those who opposed us are traitors. All those who opposed us are unpatriotic. No. Everybody was a patriot because they participated in American democracy. That's what it's about. Now we have a situation today. We have a situation today that's very grave. We're talking about going to war with Iraq. And what's lacking is that kind of democratic involvement. Where's the debate? Where's the discussion? Where's the dialogue? Where are the people?
There's been no debate.
Well, there might be on the TV, but I'll tell you what.
You guys are blessed. You are blessed with a representative who had the courage to step out, go to Baghdad, and get the crown.
And Jim McDermott has been criticized by some for daring to speak out against the policy of President Bush. Not because he spoke out. No, hey, he said the same words on the steps of the Capitol in Washington, D.C. The exact same words, but not a damn person was listening. So Jim McDermott waged peace. He went to Baghdad, he seized the bully pulpit, and he repeated his words. He repeated his words, and guess what? The world listened. And that was viewed as a threat by the Bush administration, by those neoconservatives who are pushing for war. So they attacked him. They attacked his patriotism. They questioned his loyalty to this great country, when in fact, he alone of people is the true patriot. He went forward. He gathered the data. And the people of Seattle owe him a debt. Mr. McDermott, thank you. Now, you got to understand how hard that was as a card-carrying member of the Republican Party. But seriously, the fact is, though, it's going to be a difficult struggle, ladies and gentlemen, a difficult struggle to wage peace, to stop a war, and we are running out of time. We are running out of time. The Bush administration is right now, unfortunately, the equivalent of a used car salesman. They're pulling a quick one on us. They're trying to get this war pushed, they're trying to get this war accomplished, and they're doing it rapidly. They are trying to push a war powers resolution through Congress as we speak. And it appears that Congress is going to cave in. There's a couple exceptions. There's a brave senator from West Virginia named Robert Bruce who is standing up right now as we speak. And he is holding up the Constitution of the United States, and he's saying, shame, shame, shame. This document is what we stand for. He needs help. He needs reinforcements. We need to find a way to tell Congress that they must look to the Constitution for guidance on how to respond to pressure from the White House to go to war. And when you look, I'm going to just bring this up. I travel around the world quite a bit talking about this issue, and there's a heck of a lot of anti-American sentiment out there today. I think you have to understand that. We are not well-loved, and for good reason. But I always chastise those who shout down, down, USA, because I tell them that the American people are a good people. The American people are not evil. That the American people want to do the right thing, but the American people are scared right now. The American people have been callously manipulated by the Bush administration, playing upon the politics of fear and ignorance, exploiting the horror that we felt on September 11th to cow us into submission. We are told that we are at war, and when we are at war against terror, you're either with us or you're against us. There's no room for neutrality. For those who say, I don't know. See, if you say, I don't know, you're not with us, so you must be against us. There's no room for those who raise their hand and say, excuse me, Mr. President, I have a question. If you question me, you're not with me, you're against me, you're not a patriot, you're a traitor. This is what we're fighting. This is what we're fighting. And what I tell the Europeans is that we need help. We need people to lead by example. We need our fellow democracies in Canada and Great Britain to help. And you know they are helping. In Great Britain last weekend, 450,000 people came to the streets to protest against war. And that was a signal that Tony Blair could not ignore. No, Tony Blair wanted to go to his Labour Party conference and push through a resolution that say, I, Tony Blair, will side with the United States no matter what George Bush says. And the people of England, the British democracy, said, not in our name. If you go to war, it's only with the approval of the United Nations.
And that's what happened. Success. And I asked the British people, you know, I said, quit criticizing us. Quit saying down, down USA. You're our friends. Be our friends. You guys know the saying. Friends don't let friends drive drunk. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have a drunk at the wheel of American foreign policy named George Bush. Drunk with power, drunk with arrogance, and we need help in reaching over and taking the keys out of the ignition so he doesn't drive this vehicle off the edge of a cliff. Now, here's the question I have for you. I see desire. I see desire, but do you have the will for peace? Okay? We need 1 million people to gather in Washington, D.C., holding the Constitution of the United States of America, surrounding the United States Congress, and saying, read the document, not in our name, no war, no way. Do you have the will? Do you have the will? Now, I came here tonight to help stimulate debate, discussion, and dialogue, but frankly speaking, the time is getting late. There's no more time for talk. It is time for action. You have to decide what signal you're going to send to future generations. People ask me why I'm here, why I'm doing this, and I'm doing it for my kids. I'm doing it to defend the nation I want my kids to grow up in. I don't want my kids to grow up in an American imperial power. I want them to grow up in an American democratic power. And it's power of the people, by the people, for the people. You need to take action now. Let's be very clear here. This is not going to be easy. It's going to require reaching out across your city, across your state, across your region, across your country. We need to send a signal loud and clear to Washington, D.C. that war will not be tolerated, that the Constitution will be defended, and that signal must resonate starting here tonight in Seattle. Will you help sound the signal? I'll take that as a yes. And now we're going to run a little exercise here. I've asked you to consider holding your elected representatives accountable for what they do in your name. Hold the president accountable for what he does in your name. He works for you. Hold Congress accountable for what they do in your name. And now I'm going to say, hold me accountable for what I've said here tonight. Let's begin the exchange of ideas, the exchange of discussion. Let's start the debate. I'm ready to take any questions anybody has. Thank you very much.
You're listening to a talk by former United Nations Chief Weapons Inspector in Iraq, Scott Ritter, given earlier this month. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1. This is Unwelcome Guests. Ritter continues.